described by someone laying out some of the more dramatic things that have happened lately with sterilization that have been in the news. One, the Indian experience, somebody's, I mean, the experience in India, and perhaps even to a large extent the defeat of the Gandhi government there can be attributed to the forced sterilization. And this mass forced sterilization that was being carried out in India and which resulted in at least 300 deaths of people over the rioting, you know, people who were killed as they opposed the mass sterilization campaign, I think it certainly highlighted for the world sort of the logical conclusion of some of the population control programs and what that may be. Another thing that's been in the news recently was the revelation that Native American women were being sterilized in large numbers by the government health services, that is the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Indian Health Services. To what extent, I don't think we still know, and I was going through this report from the Comptroller General of the United States, dated November 4, 1976, to the United States Senator Aburizek, and I'll share with you some of the data that they come forth with, remembering that this is the Health Services report, not the Native American people's report, and some of the implications from it. But I think, you know, when we look at this, we say, okay, Native Americans in the United States and Indians in India, and it's basically we're talking about forced sterilization, and what does this mean? And when we see it in historical context, the fact is that forced sterilization is a time-honored procedure in the United States. That the first forced sterilization laws were passed in 1907. And I thought I might just read you something of the sample law that was actually proposed as the law that should be accepted by the states. And mainly what was proposed was in 1907, the Indiana legislature was the first to pass an act to prevent procreation of confirmed criminals, idiots, imbeciles, and rapists held in state institutions and certified as beyond rehabilitation. And that was the first example of a compulsory sterilization law. It went on to declare that heredity plays a most important part in the transmission of crime, idiocy, and imbecility. And this was a statement that was accepted by the propagandists. And this went on to become law in 30 of the states of the Union and is still in the books of 27 with variants here and there. And between 1907 and 1964 or thereabouts, 65,000 people were sterilized under these laws throughout the United States. This, I think, came as a revelation to me because I got involved in the sterilization work, you know, before delving into the whole history of it, and I'll give you a little bit of how that came to be later. But I think the important thing to note about this, that we live in a country which had defined sterilization as a modality to be used upon certainly defined segments of the population. And that sets a framework, like anything else that's legally sanctioned. I mean, if you legally sanction, well, the death penalty or corporal punishment or this or the other thing, it very often transcends the limits of the institutions. I mean, if corporal punishment goes on in the schools for the retarded or the homes for the retarded, it's going to go into the general educational system and it's going to go into the streets. I mean, there's no way of containing social practices, and this is exactly what has happened with sterilization. So that, well, we know about the 65,000 people sterilized under the laws, then how about the millions sterilized outside of those laws because being welfare recipients or poor people or in some other fashion?
What were the dates for the 65,000?
The 65,000 from 1907 through 1964. So then we have to examine that framework. The fact then remains that in terms of sterilization, the people who were to be sterilized are variously defined, but they always fall in the same category of people, meaning the people who are poor in the society, the people who are working, employed, and unemployed. And this seems to have been clearly the pattern in the United States. That in the United States it takes on a racial overtones is because the working strata of this country has racial overtones. I mean, it has the racial implications as to where you are on the socioeconomic scale, and that's also the truth of the matter. But the famous Buck versus Bell case, or Bell versus Buck, I don't know how you state it, Stephanie Buck happened to be a poor white young woman who was said to be mentally retarded, had already born one illegitimate child, and when she was simply going to be sterilized under the laws, there was a challenge to the laws which went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and that's when Justice Holmes gives the very famous opinion of something like four generations of idiots is enough was the crux of the matter. And actually, the thinking that prevailed in that opinion was the thinking that this so-called mental retardation was hereditary. So that again, we see as a justification for the whole question of sterilization, very often this basis, you know, of saying whatever it is, and it can be inability to cope with the school system, or dropping out of high school, or having low IQs for all the scientific validity that the IQs may have, and saying this then justifies it. So it doesn't surprise us then, looking at this framework, that there have been at least 10 states where the idea that compulsory sterilization should be done to welfare people has been proposed, and they've been bills. So far, they haven't been passed in any state, compulsory sterilization for welfare recipients. But they have been proposed, and in some state legislatures they have been defeated by very, very narrow margins, as narrow as one vote. So it seems to be a question of social climate. In terms of the state legislatures, well, various state legislators, of course. But the idea is widely prevalent. I mean, there is a thing we can call the population control movement, and that is something that really has initially the eugenics justification to it in the United States. That is, that the population control notion, which you might say Malthus first enunciates, that somehow the riches of the world, you know, increase at an arithmetic rate in the population geometry. Malthus was clearly talking not about everybody. He was talking about the English working people. And just as clearly in his writings as he proposes not to share with those people, with the poor, the knowledge on hygienic measures that might decrease their mortality, because in that way they would increase in outlandish ways. This movement, which we might say originates with him, which in the United States begins to form around the turn of the century and ends up becoming the American Breeders Association, which actually was concerned with cattle more than with people, were then asked by President Taft to form the first commission on improving the racial stock of the American people. And out of the work of these folks came the restrictive immigration laws and the establishment of the various population councils and so on that formed part of the population control movement. So that it's a complexity of forces But basically, these were forces which united part of the scientific establishment, as it comes in from the eugenics, with part of the political establishment, which was asking the eugenists to rationalize, justify, and institutionalize a series of practices, dictating, you know, what the composition of this country's people should be, and obviously aimed at the poor. And the thought, unfortunately, is very prevalent. I mean, there have been some surveys, for instance, among obstetricians. One recent survey showed that although only about one quarter of them would favor sterilization for their private patients, about three quarters of them favored it for their welfare patients. You know, it's the same bunch of obstetricians. So it's very clear, you know, that not everybody is the same in the eyes of some folks. And a number of polls taken among the public at large show that the idea of the welfare people being sterilized is very prevalent. It's very prevalent. I forget the exact thing. There was a Gallup poll with something like 60-some-odd% of people polled said that they would favor compulsory sterilization.
Is this compulsory sterilization of welfare people, is it after a woman has had X number of children, or is it...
That was the proposals have been generally thus, yes, right. They've been put after two children in some places, after three children in another. As far as I know, no one's actually proposed that welfare people be sterilized childless. Mm-hmm. But that might come. I think the notion that I want to communicate to you is that ever since the beginning, the whole... The question of sterilization has been tied in with the population control, unlike birth control, other modalities of birth control, we might say, or the birth control movement in itself, which is an inception with Margaret Sanger and Emma Goldman, and I think Linda Gordon's book is one of the best sources for understanding this history. And its inception had somewhat of a progressive quality about it. It was purported to particularly save women from dying in childbirth. And the dying in childbirth had to do with women, you know, who could not control their fecundity and had one pregnancy after another. And this was particularly the working women and the unemployed working people. That this, in its inception, was rejected by the eugenicists. The eugenicists did not want birth control information spread around. And one of the reasons they said they didn't want birth control information spread around was because the more educated classes would use birth control, and that was race suicide. People were limiting their numbers, while the others were not limiting their numbers, and therefore, you know, this should not be. So anybody that thinks that the eugenicists were on the side of women's rights or individual rights or, you know, right to control of our fertility, forget that idea. They were not. It was only when they began to see that birth control might be very useful to them as a modality, because their favorite form was sterilization. That was the, you know, final solution to the problem of whoever should not breed, and not something that was within the control of the people themselves, like birth control. But a meeting really occurred, one that Margaret Sanger in particular became more and more, I don't know if we can say it as a transition, but she was a socialist to begin with, but her publications and a great deal of the work that she did was tainted with the notion that there were people, racist notions you might call it, that there were people who should not breed in the same number. So it became a sort of transition where she began getting closer to the eugenicists, because she did share some ideas with the eugenicists. And this is true of practically everything around World War I. We're talking about, you know, that couple of decades there from 1910 to say the 1930s, when you had a great deal of prevalence even in the very left organized movements of working people, the idea that there were the foreigners who had come in large groups prior to the Immigration Restriction Act of 1924, who were to some extent undesirable. Of course, the blacks were considered to be undesirable. So that in a way, the notions of racism that were so much a part of everybody's thinking is what allowed that growing together of the birth control movement and the population control people. So that Margaret Sanger passes on to become part of the Planned Parenthood and international Planned Parenthood kind of structure, which is basically rooted in the population control notion. Other than the fact that she married a millionaire in 1922, and I'm sure that influenced her thinking. If it wasn't influenced before, how come she married a millionaire? Emma Goldman remained a socialist and went a different direction with it. So once more, when we look at the facts then of what's been happening in the United States in terms of sterilization, then it becomes clear that sterilization as a tool to be used by certain groups, punitive, controlling, however you want to phrase it, came in long before it became a fashionable modality with which to control procreation. That's really a very recent notion in terms of thinking. So that the medical establishment limited sterilization to doing it on those they thought it should be done, and would not do it to those they thought shouldn't get it. And so that women, say, 8 years ago, 10 years ago in the United States had an exceedingly difficult time if they were white, if they were married, if they were in any way, you know, slated to breed, had been singled out to breed, had a hard time getting sterilization. And case after case has been documented of that sort of difficulty. Including in more recent years, there's a study by Susan Scrimshaw on women in East Harlem where she contrasts the higher rates among Puerto Rican women than among black. It was 16% of women of childbearing age among the Puerto Ricans in East Harlem, and only 5% among the black women, saying that many of the Puerto Rican women who wanted to be sterilized went to Puerto Rico to have the operation done because they were refused within the city system and the private system. And this just, you know, around 1970, she's talking about 1968, 69, 1970. But something different has happened, and this, again, has been something recent in the past 5 years, is that sterilization as a modality has been sold to people, and access has been opened up, so that most obstetrical departments no longer apply the rule of the 120, that your parity times your age had to equal 120 or more in order to have a sterilization. So now they're challenging the health education and welfare guidelines of sterilization under 21 years of age, and are saying teenagers ought to have a right to be sterilized. And that has opened up a whole new area about sterilization. So somebody like Jane Brody can go out and get a laparoscopic sterilization and write a very glowing account of how happy she was to get it and bought 3 pairs of shoes and so on, and basically sort of support the idea of simple band-aid surgery that people shouldn't be concerned about, and hiding the facts of the whole long history of forced sterilization and how this has been carried out. So in terms of the extra legal type of sterilization, one of the key cases is the Ralph case. And I think the Ralph case illustrates a great deal how it was being done. Because with the Ralph children, who were not institutionalized children, there were two sisters aged 12 and 14 years old, black girls from Alabama, who in 1973 were taken by the social services. And so we're talking about extra institutional, we're talking about extra legal kind of ways of doing things, who were taken and sterilized. And the thing breaks out when they sue the social services. The family learns about it. One cousin locked herself in a room, a 17-year-old locked herself in a room, and that's how she was able to get away from being sterilized. When the case breaks out and they sue the government and they sue actually health education and welfare because they were Medicaid, and this is under which they were getting reimbursement. The girls were asked to sign sheets saying they were over 21 years of age. The mother, who couldn't read and write, had put a cross on the consent form. The ruling by Judge Gesell then stipulates, one, that the forced sterilization of people on welfare is rampant in the country. I mean, that it seemed very well documented that that was happening to America's poor. And two, then, that HGW had to develop certain guidelines to avoid such occurrences in the future. And the guidelines said no sterilizations of people judged to be mentally incompetent. And if, obviously, if you're mentally retarded, then you can't. It was a moratorium, 1973 ruling, moratorium on the sterilization of the mental incompetent, which would then put a stop to all the institutionalized people who are being sterilized around. Two, that there's no one under 21 years of age could be sterilized. This is all talking about Medicaid reimbursement. Remember that AGW can make guidelines only in terms of the money it's going to lay out for the services, and cannot make guidelines that will rule practice as a whole, medical practice as a whole. Three, that there had to be an informed consent procedure, and specifically they spelled out that informed consent procedure meant a fair explanation of the procedure, an explanation of the risks, an explanation of the benefits, an explanation of the alternative procedures, what alternative people had, and that there should be no coercive factors, including that people should be clearly told that they had a right to refuse and that their welfare benefits would not suffer as a result of their refusal. And so that these things were clearly spelled out, and a 72-hour waiting period. And these were promulgated in early 1974, actually in the fall of 1973, the guidelines. Nearly a year later, a survey done by the Health Research Council, which was later corroborated by Lisa Krauss and the American Civil Liberties Union, showed that only about 3% of institutions, and they surveyed mainly teaching institutions, were in compliance with those guidelines. That a lot of them, you know, just provided practically no informed consent procedure, that the consent forms they used were blank forms saying, you know, I hereby permit Dr. So-and-so to perform on me the operation of blank, without any real explanation. And it's only 3%. That was the initial study, you know, in compliance with the stipulations of the guidelines. It's larger now, but there's been a lot of pressure on it, and I'll tell you something about a recent survey later. At any rate, what this showed, welfare rights people in Washington sued against the guidelines almost immediately because they said there were inadequate protections. So that, in a way, you know, there was, on the one hand, the institutions weren't abiding by them, on the other hand, people who felt that they really wanted to have abuse prevented felt that they were inadequate. And furthermore, of course, they only applied to one sector of the population, admittedly probably the most abused sector, but it's still one sector of the population. A whole lot of working poor people who are not on welfare, and a whole lot of people who, you know, are not even working poor, whose rights really should be taken into consideration. There was another case, which is, by the way, these cases are still unresolved. That is, the Ralph case is still an active suit, of the 11 Chicano women in Los Angeles County, and their claims of abuse were in institution, that is, in the hospital itself. Most of them were approached around the time of labor. Some of them didn't know any English at all and were shown a form in English and asked to sign. A few of them mentioned that they were approached during labor itself, and asked, you know, one was asked, don't you want to feel these pains anymore? She said no, and it's a little sign here, and ended up being sterilized. By the way, this is a common story. We've heard a great deal, I mean, of actual experiences in New York City also, being approached at this time. Another one was approached while still in the effects of anesthesia. And In the ruling about that, Judge Gesell also said that another stipulation had to be that they provide informative materials and the consent form in the language spoken or understood by women, and not necessarily read and written. So from there, I think we have to conclude that one, sterilization abuse has been around for a long time, since they put sterilizations, that it has been sanctioned by law, that it is something that unfortunately many people have in their minds as maybe a legitimate way of dealing with poverty and with a lot of other social problems, and that the population control establishment has really furthered that notion by pushing the whole question of population control as the answer. You know, how do you decrease the welfare rolls? Do you sterilize people? How do you decrease the mentally retarded? You sterilize people. How do you decrease the criminality? You sterilize people. You know, with this, this notion. And I think the case in Puerto Rico, which is really what got me interested as a Puerto Rican and working in the whole sterilization area, is a case in point about how social policy can be so ingrained that then it becomes the norm. So whereas maybe 10 years ago people say, sterilization, well today people say, what? You know, sterilization. I'm going to have it done tomorrow. I already have two children. That we begin to accept certain things as the norm. Fact is that in Puerto Rico, sterilization has been for quite a while, for certainly at least 10 or 15 years, the main modality of birth control. So that today, over one-third of the Puerto Rican women of childbearing age have already been sterilized. And what does this mean and how was it accomplished is still a number of areas that we have no idea of how it functions. But we can say that the institution of a government program of sterilization, that putting this government program of sterilization for the two-thirds of the population that the government serve free health services to within the health services, that the fact that women weren't really getting alternative methods, they weren't supplying them with the pills or with the diaphragms or with anything else during this period of time, plus coupled with the fact that you had many social factors, women being drawn in large numbers into the job marketplace during the period of industrialization in the 40s. No family support services to speak of, you know, daycare, nursery schools, etc. Mass migration, primarily of men as migrant agricultural workers, as workers in basic industry, and a number of other, certainly all the menial jobs we have on the East Coast, particularly New York City, that created such a degree of social dislocation during that first decade of the Popular Party's government from 1940 on, that really basically pushed women into it. And with that, we have information that at least a quarter of them had mistaken notions about the reversibility of it. And there's a very meaningful to me quote from the man who was running the program recently until the advent of the new government now with the elections last year, Dr. Antonio Silva, who said in an interview in 1976 that it wasn't true, as all these independentists were charging, that his government had really pushed mass sterilizations for women, although, mind you, at this point in time they were building 19 other centers specifically for sterilization. They escalated their so-called educational campaign down to the junior high school level on population control, and I wish I had some of the slides here to show you, but the posters that they have even for children, you know, one showing a little girl pushing dolls into this bursting dollhouse and saying, dolls are very pretty, but can you really fit them in, you know, to elementary school. One showing horrible-looking people clambering over each other, you know, with sort of like kicking each other in the face as they climb on each other, saying, to avoid this disaster, we must plan our families now, you know, sort of overflowing from the map of the island, falling into the ocean, and pushing each other out. You know, this kind of real, like fear city kind of propaganda they had for New York a while ago. You know, the same kind of notion about people. That they also escalated this a great deal besides the center. So led by this man who was conducting this program, but it wasn't true as he was being accused. That actually, since they had begun providing women with the information that one, the operation was permanent, and two, that there were alternative methods and an effort was being made to give them alternative methods, that the number of sterilizations had decreased from 1975, that was 6,700, to 4,200 in 1976. And then for 30 years, they started sterilizing in 1940. So they're telling us for 30 years, they weren't giving adequate information on alternative methods. And they're also not telling people that it was permanent. And this is very true. We have found the notion so ingrained in woman after woman that tying of the tubes meant that they could be untied. Woman after woman has signed affidavits, you know, documenting the question of abuse, saying that she thought that they could be untied, that, or she thought that the sutures dissolved automatically in about a period of 5 years. So that there were many, many women before it was a reversible procedure. So then that pushes us into seeing, okay, what is the social climate that can create, you know, a move toward really massive sterilization, and what are the factors in terms of people's knowledge and people's, you know, weapons with which to defend themselves that have to do with changing that social climate and not letting the social climate create that kind of situation where you have had such a huge, massive number of women being sterilized and so many of them evidencing regret later.
Puerto Rico,
right. So that when I mentioned before Susan Scrimshaw's study with the 16%, it included some women who had been sterilized in Puerto Rico, you know, as she did. It was a prevalent study. She did the study, but women who had also lived in New York and had gone to Puerto Rico to get la operación, you know. Mm-hmm. And it does establish, somebody asked me the other day, she said, you know, well, my mother was sterilized, my aunt, and she said, and my cousin, and, you know, how do you fight sterilization abuse in a country where it's called out the operation? Yeah? And I think it's a very difficult thing to do because you're also coping with the same social factors. I mean, the factors there of the women having to work and the factors of the lack of access to other birth control and what it means, even if it's not supplied by the health services, if the birth control is costly. And the factors of the lack of family support services and the massive unemployment, I mean, all these things are real and are real for women on a day-to-day basis. And I think what you have to say there, well, okay, you fight for the health rights and you also fight for full information, but you have to, beyond that, talk about the supportive services that people need to be able to make uncoerced choices. I mean, where are the factors of coercion? Let me jump a minute back to New York, though, because we have some recent information that people are receiving in writing from the social services departments, people in welfare, in writing a statement to the fact that no further children will be supported on welfare. I haven't gotten a letter here. I just learned it last week from some of the people who are on welfare, who are organized. And I think this is a very scary kind of development for New York City. Actually, the woman who received the letter is pregnant now. And she was told, okay, this is your last child. So talk about factors of coercion that wouldn't show up in any other way, but you know, what's the decision made? The Hyde Amendment and the relationship between that and sterilization of poor people, I think, should be very clear to all of us. If you cut out access to abortion, the next pregnancy may be the one that ends up with a package deal, you know, where you deliver and you also get sterilized. So then I'm going to just leave a lot of room for discussion because I know there must be 1,001 questions flying around. I'd just like to end and very briefly tell you something about the struggle for sterilization guidelines. In New York City, the recent struggle for a law governing more than just the health and hospitals, corporation hospitals, and some of what I think that means. So aware of the fact that the HEW guidelines were not totally satisfactory, and I'll tell you the areas we became aware of. If you look at when sterilization consents are obtained from women, over 90% of the consents are obtained around the time of abortion or around the time of childbirth. 2, 72 hours definitely allowed for obtaining consent at such time and sterilizing the woman before she left the hospital. That is, if you obtain consent around labor, before the woman goes home in 3 days, you can do the sterilization. So that these were particularly key areas, we thought, in terms of violating the whole notion of truly uncoerced consent. The other thing that seemed to be was that the informed consent procedure wasn't sufficiently spelled out as to guarantee that people really knew what they were talking about. And any of us who's been in any medical facility, you know that it's very easy to hear the mumbo-jumbo. I mean, I've heard doctors saying, well, your child has a interventricular septal defect to a mother. And, you know, what does this mean? And, you know, that this kind of barrage that we get from the of control, really, of even the way a doctor is looked at and so on, how that functions in terms of a coercive situation is also very true indeed, and the glaring absence of patient advocates from the system and so on. So we thought that was another thing that should be clearly spelled out. What should be the procedure for them? The we, basically people who were working in the Health and Hospitals Corporation, who had previously not been working in the Health and Hospitals Corporation and had been noting the fact that the number of sterilizations being performed in the city hospitals had risen tremendously, some as many as tripled in the 2 years between 1973 and 1975. So there was a serious concern, and the increase seemed greatest in the Puerto Rican neighborhoods. So that the liberalization of the so-called access was very suspicious of also leading to a situation of abuse. And let me remind you in that context that 80% of the sterilizations performed in New York City are on welfare women, and that is disproportionate because 80% of the women are not on welfare in the city. So, plus the population study data showing that about 1/5 of black married women were sterilized, and showing again a disproportionate number of black women, and we don't have much data in Chicana, and then she Native American is apparently one group that's got a very high percentage also. And looking at that, you know, sort of suspicion that something is going on all over the country that the liberalization has allowed to happen in a, perhaps a more significant way than previously. The other part of the we are people, health rights, health pack, ourselves who had at that point organized the committee to end sterilization abuse, a number of people on the community boards of the hospitals, some church groups that were very, very leery of this whole situation. And we got together in a committee which was called the Advisory Committee on Sterilization Guidelines. We met over a period of time. We examined from the literature and from the cold experience of people the areas we thought abuse was more likely to take place, and we came up with a series of draft guidelines. The draft guidelines provided for one, I mean, same thing as HEW, no one judged to be mentally incompetent, no one under 20 years of age, because we thought that was a very correct kind of stipulation. To a waiting period of, initially we had said 60 days, but in the negotiating we brought it down to 30. A 30-day waiting period between time of consent and time of carrying out the procedure. Spelling out the informed consent procedure so it even included feedback from the woman as to what she understood that procedure was going to mean. She could do it on her own, or she could do it through an interpreter, however she felt comfortable with it. provision for a patient advocate designated by the woman to be accompany her throughout the whole explanation, you know, educational sessions, the procedure itself, if need be. That the witness to the consent should be another than the physician who was proposing the procedure. That specifically physicians should not be the people initiating the request for sterilization. And at least informational materials to be printed in at least 6 languages, which included here in New York City, Yiddish, Chinese, French, Spanish, English, Italian. What were thought to be the major languages, but allowance for any other language, you know, that the woman might speak to bring her advocate, her own interpreter. Then, and this was another sticky one, I mean, the two bones of real contention were the 30-day waiting period, and the other one was that consent should not be obtained during hospitalization, either for abortion or for childbirth or for any other major procedure, because we all felt that that's when women were particularly vulnerable to being coerced, particularly the abortion deals, which are also package deals. A survey done of teaching hospitals showed that a large number of teaching hospitals offered abortions if women would also sign consent for sterilization, sort of neatly rolled up into one. Now, I don't want to go into the details of the struggles over this, but suffice it to say, I mean, that we have a file yay long, which includes even poisoned pen letters from some of the obstetrically-minded individuals, you know, obscene punk of just incredible kind of opposition, most virulent from the chiefs of service of the 15 hospitals which are municipal and have obstetrical services. And the stories they always brought up, you know, there's this Grava 10 who never comes in between times for birth control methods, and there she is, and this is the only time you can get her. You know, literally, these are now quoting from sessions that we had with them, negotiating sessions. There's this habitual aborter who, you know, just comes in time after time to abort and refuses to use any kind of birth control methods in between, and that's when you can get this one time, you know, she's going to sign it. And, you know, this went on and on and on and on. The particular thing, we were forced to negotiate on the definition of sterilization, although the thinking of the committee was that there's no such thing as a medically indicated sterilization. You may have medical indications for not having children, which is not necessarily a medical indication for sterilization. You may opt to use that as your method of birth control, but that should be strictly an elective procedure. We got stuck on that. I mean, they just were not in any way going to allow anyone to get into the idea of the medical practice. I mean, that's where the, you know, don't tread on me kind of thing, the snakes are gonna come and get you if you talk about regulation of medical practice. So this is where I'd say we finally have to just make the guidelines for elective and then let them define what they thought was medically indicated, although they refused to put themselves down on paper as to the definition of medical indications or even to bring forth a list of what they consider medical indications for sterilization.
Could you give us an idea of what that would be?
When do they consider? Actually, we couldn't pin them down, but let me tell you some of the things they say. They say a woman with, say, intractable heart disease who should not get pregnant, and that's a medical indication for sterilization.
You know what I mean?
Well, what you're asking is it more dangerous to have an abortion than to
where's the danger? In the pregnancy itself or in giving birth?
In the pregnancy itself, but particularly the latter part of the pregnancy. As far as heart disease is concerned, that specific example, the real problem is in the third trimester when blood volume increases,
right,
and the overload in the heart is likely to be greater. the early months or not. But you might say she's a bigger risk for anesthesia or anything that may require that. I mean, you might make a case for it. But once more, you know, the argument I think still holds that a woman who has intractable heart disease, given the choices, may decide, yes, I'd rather be sterilized. But that should not be considered a medical indication ipso facto. And then they give you examples. Somebody was giving us the example the other day of a woman who had eight children and changed her mind. She actually requested sterilization, but then when she had the eighth child, she changed her mind, and she had a ninth pregnancy, the uterus ruptured, and she died. You know, I mean, exactly. I mean, maybe if she had known all the options, maybe she wouldn't have changed her mind. But again, I think the decision is up to the person who's going to go undergo the procedure.
The uterus could have ruptured after the first child, too.
Exactly. Well, it's more like it's what they call a grand mal tempora. You know, that's about somebody who's been pregnant more than eight times or brought to term more than eight times. But this wasn't one of the indications they gave. Other indication they gave was repeat cesarean sections. And on that, there's a great deal of difference of opinion. That is, there those obstetricians themselves who think there is no such thing as a greater danger. You know, the low cervical incision is what's done now instead of the fundal incision. So there were those who said, you know, it doesn't make any difference, but the ones who were pushing for leaving medical indicators said that a medical indication was, you know, more than two cesarean sections. So they were willing to sterilize every woman who's had two cesarean sections, and, you know, so on. And it got to the point of the ridiculous, because in the testimony given by one of the obstetricians from Kings County Hospital, I think deputy director of the department, his argument when asked by Carter Burden, who is the man who proposed the legislation I'm going to tell you a little bit about, this obstetrician said that varicose veins were an indication. That, you know, he said that over 95% of the sterilizations done in Kings County were medically indicated. In other words, you know, the regulations only applied to 5%. That's really what he was saying. And Kings County performed a hysterectomy on a 19-year-old black woman who came in for an abortion as a prisoner from Rikers Island after the guidelines were supposed to be enforced. And she went to Kings County for the abortion, and they asked her to sign consent to a sterilization, and they informed her that it was reversible and that when she became a normal citizen, she could have it returned. Whereupon they botched the abortion, perforated the uterus, and she ended up with a hysterectomy. And she said, but this is Kings County, you know, because whenever we got into it, they said, oh, well, Puerto Rico, there's abuse, in Alabama, there's abuse, North Carolina, and Los Angeles, but prove there's abuse in New York. Prove there's abuse, you know. So that's when we started collecting the affidavits, because actually, you know, we had to get some proof, but that proof they manufactured actually on this young woman. That was their doing. Just kind of incredible. Okay, so then let me tell you then a little bit then about where we went forth from with the guidelines. So we have at least an hour to discuss. With the guidelines then, what we did was we managed to get them passed. Whereupon the same obstetricians who had been negotiating with us, I mean, they had appointed a committee of five of them from the 15, five of them of the sort of more easygoing types to meet with five of us who were self-selected, those of us who were willing to meet with obstetricians at 8 o'clock in the morning for a number of sessions and everybody's cup of tea. And we did, we negotiated, and originally they approved the joint guidelines. I think the politics of it was that they got their next rung when they went back to the rest of the group who had not been involved in the negotiations for being too soft and for allowing the waiting period and for allowing the interdiction of consent during time of abortion and time of childbirth. And then they reneged. And just as the guidelines were about to be passed, they sent a 3-page telegram to the board that was going to pass the guidelines saying that they had not really been a party to those guidelines, et cetera, and disclaiming all things. What managed to pass the guidelines was that the community board were very much in favor of the guidelines, and it was really what tipped it. Also, the HHC was in a slightly state of crisis, and you know, you could sort of get things in quickly at that point in time because they were so concerned about the cuts and budgets and so on that the focus of attention wasn't exactly the guidelines. So the problem then became twofold. One, how do you implement these things? So you got them. You fought them through. We had a good working coalition of mainly women who managed to regulate, to some extent, medical practice, a kind of unprecedented act on our part. We felt, you know, that this had been a good move, but then what do you do about it? And then the task remains and is still a question of how we organize around this, that we must develop within the institutions themselves the kind of watchdog committees that are going to make sure that whatever regulation is, it gets implemented. And for that, we need to do a tremendous job of community organizing too. You've got to make sure everybody steps in there has the knowledge that the guidelines exist and what they mean. And we've been preparing some materials, you know, to inform the people about them. And in some places, such as Kings County, some coalitions have developed around, you know, a number of health issues, but that are also very aware of the need for the guideline compliance. Two, remember that Medicaid reimbursement takes place whether something is done in a private or public hospital. And the folks from New York Medical College, for instance, who are both at Metropolitan and Flower Fifth, said, well, if we get bothered by this, we'll stop doing them in Metropolitan and we'll do them in Flower Fifth. Metropolitan is a city hospital, Flower Fifth is a private hospital. It would be the same people, the same medical school, the same obstetricians, the same everything. So they could just shift the focus. And as it turns out, of the 12,000 documented sterilizations done on Medicaid patients last year, I'm either telling you 76, 9,000 of them were in the private hospital. So that tells you that they could very easily get out of the guidelines.
The guidelines only applied
to city hospitals, right, because they were only passed for health and hospitals, corporation hospitals, which are the municipal system. We finally got them in 4 of 75, I think it was October, and they were going to become effective November, right?
Is this sort of duality?
November 1st.
Is this sort of duality between like private and public hospitals happening in other
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, including the kind of play with funds, because mm-hmm. the same institution. So they pay, say, the consultants, the subspecialists in the medical school, supposedly to go to that public institution from the public fund. They may or they may not go. You know, whatever. They still are the ones who set it up so that the cash flow is in the direction of their private setup and the supports of them. Same with the kinds of services they offer. I mean, in Kings County, women who want a diaphragm have to go to downstate, to the private part of the clinic. They say, well, it's across the street. It's not a question of where it is geographically. It's that it's a completely different setup that's not even accountable to the public or open.
Yeah,
you know. Right, not accountable. I think that's one of the main features of it that makes this kind of place so bad for all of us. At any rate, seeing that, then Carter Burden, whom I mentioned as a city councilman, who has some very good people in his staff, because actually his staff, I think, was crucial in getting this, then proposed a bill which would make it mandatory for New York City for any sterilization procedure of a man or woman, irrespective of whether inpatient, outpatient, or whatever, to follow guidelines. So that meant that the game with the private hospital had to stop, that they also had to follow guidelines. And the big victory was just obtained this Monday when the health committee of the city council voted unanimously to endorse the bill. So that means that we have gotten to a city level at least. The state was about to pass amended guidelines because the state guidelines are very similar to the HEW on 72 hours and so on without any real teeth in it. And the state has been waiting to see what happens in the city for it to come out with its proposal. I think if we do get a city, and I just wanted to end up distributing the how you can help sheet, that the important thing of our being able to get this through the city, one, that it has taken lovely kind of unity to get it to that stage. I think one of the things that I was most pleased about was the endorsement by NOW. And when we join forces with the other, Barbara Caress, who has the NOW letter, will share that with us so you can get an idea of what happened. Because initially, a large sector of the feminist movement saw this whole question of legislation, particularly the waiting period, which was the sticky one with the obstetricians, as being very threatening. And that's because there was some confusion about the idea of demand and control. I mean, the slogan had been abortion on demand. I got confused with the idea of sterilization on demand. Why should you have to wait for sterilization? And it's been a whole educational process which we have undergone together to see that the coercive factors are so great and the abuse is so great that that waiting period becomes absolutely essential to prevent it. And that although it may inconvenience some people who maybe have made up their minds and have read everything about it and, you know, just simply want it and maybe you're going to go traveling next week, that, you know, it's an inconvenience, but it certainly doesn't louse you up for the rest of your life the way a sterilization you didn't want does. You know, so, and I think that's been a very important part of enlightenment, that certainly brought us closer to understanding. The other thing I think has been clear is about the issues of racism, which the whole sterilization thing has erased, you know, not just the class, access to information, access to your own doctor, you know, this kind of luxury of being able to discuss your own body with anybody rather than being just thrown in this mill of the clinics, as we know them, that, again, the question of how it is for different people and the significance it has, for instance, to be a Native American, of whom maybe there are 1 million full-blooded in this whole nation and who have been subjected to, you know, maybe the genocide, yeah, right. What does it mean for sterilization there versus what does it mean for me to choose it after having had 3 children because I don't want to have 4, you know? That this is very significant in terms of peoples, of groups of people, of nationalities, of ethnic groups within the United States. I'm beginning to understand that factor a little bit better, and I think that's been very, very crucial in getting the Carter Burton thing as far as it's been. I think the NOW endorsement is a very, very important part of it. So I'll stop right there, and then we can discuss maybe some of the